Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you want to go to rugby heaven? Let's go back to 1987 with Squidge. With Squidge, let's go back to 87 with Squidge.
Hello and welcome to the Squidge Rugby World Cup retrospective, where our task for the evening is to try and somehow spin what that commentator said out into an hour or so. I am Robbie or Squidge, whatever you want to call me. I'm joined by Mr. Will Owen. How are you doing?
I'm all right. And to be honest, I think after watching this game, I could really, really do with being out of my depth in some gardening-based conversations, right?
Yeah. And I want to say a big welcome back and sorry to from the Blood and Mud podcast, Lee Calvert. How are we doing? How are we?
Hello, I'm fine. I would much rather have a full gardening-based conversation than talk about this thing that we have to talk about for the next however long it lasts.
I saw a photo of your garden last week and it looks incredible.
It's been a lot of work. It's been a lot of work. Yes.
Yeah, you can tell.
It's a big plot. I don't like to brag, but it is. I live in North Wales. You get a big plot for a lot less money than a lot of other places. But too big, which is why I've let half of it go to meadow on purpose so I can mow it. But yeah, my next task, Will, is I've got 150 tulip bulbs coming in 2 weeks. I've got to plant them. That's my little treat for the autumn. This is who I am now, and I'm leaning hard into it.
I was going to say,
you would have been a billionaire in Holland in the 1800s.
I would, yeah. Yeah.
It's happened at some point where, like, I've maybe seen you, like, post a photo of your garden on Instagram or something, and it's made me realise, like, oh, wait, no, this is what I listen to every Monday, is discussions about this. I need to, like, look at this and really take this in and, like, show interest in it, because I have heard so many hours of conversation between you and Josh about that garden.
My next step is I'm going to post like a zonal map of it so I can say, right, anybody who's listening, I'm talking about box X3 and the planting that's going on there. That's my next step, really, really focus in for the listener experience.
I've just realised I should really, really make some jokes about the fact his name's Josh Gardner.
You know what? That's never crossed my mind before, but it's amazing. Yeah. It's right there, isn't it? It's right there.
You can have that for free on the first,
thank you very
first
much.
Episode of the next series
Don't tell
of Blood
him, I'll spring that on him next year.
Yeah, yeah.
He can just do that thing where he looks at me.
The last time you had me on Blood and Mud, I, the weekend beforehand, deliberately did the last bit of DIY I had hanging over from moving last year.
Like you're going to get in trouble.
And yeah. Like I feel like I've got to be prepared. And he didn't ask me about it. It didn't come up.
That's it. So I've now been on Blood and Mud, I believe, maybe twice. I think when I'm once with you, Lee, and once with just Josh, right? And the first time when I was on with you, the very first question you asked me was, oh, have you done any DIY lately? And I was like, oh, shit, I didn't really prepare for this. And I kind of remembered throughout the course of the conversation. And then the next time, I like made an act of to note down, like, oh, yeah, haven't done anything that could be interpreted as DIY this weekend, and Josh didn't bring it up, funnily enough. But if ever I appear again, do you know that there will be notes made?
Absolutely. I will prepare. I'll let you know before so you can actually prepare an answer. You don't leave guests looking foolish, do you?
No, of course not. Of course not.
No, we would never do that, hence getting you on this game.
Yeah.
This game lasted a long time, is what I would say.
It felt it, didn't it? The game today is England 3, Wales 16 from the quarterfinal. The quarterfinal of the 1987 Rugby World Cup. It took place in Brisbane. I think that's about all I've got to say about it. And we'll see you next week.
So this was allegedly a game that took place between two of the 8 best teams in the world. here.
I mean, at least
is that what a quarterfinal is? You know, I just
at
don't
least
want to
this one was it. This World Cup was invitation only. There was no qualifying, so they might have just not invited one of the best teams.
That's true. Like, I mean, I'd like to hope they did invite 7 of the best teams. Yeah. Yes.
Notoriously, this hasn't come up on the podcast, but Western Samoa are on standby right up until like the day before the World Cup, just in case they had to fly out if someone dropped out, because they're worried about Fiji and someone else maybe dropping out last minute.
Wow.
So they just had Western Samoa going like, we might need you, lads.
Yeah.
Western Samoa just had their piss on a rolling boil for the next 4 years until they turned up in Cardiff, basically, yeah.
Fiji very did have ready. Their coup like 9 days before the World Cup, yep. So it makes sense to have somebody on standby, but that's funny. But this game wasn't.
I mean, so...
there were some funny bits. I'll have to say there were some bits where I did actually laugh out loud, which we'll get to.
Lee, I mean, so we haven't had you on since the 2011 series. What did you make of watching this back? And what are your kind of... what's your relationship pre-existing with kind of this era of rugby?
Not well, so obviously in 1987, you two were still at least 25 years from away from being born. Weren't you? but in 1987, I was 11 and I just moved to Wales actually after my parents got divorced. I just moved to North Wales.
Was it like you moved to whoever won this game?
Yes. Yeah, I was sat there crying, tears running down my face. I'm going to move from Lancashire because of you, Mike Harrison. Yeah, but it's like So I just moved to Wales. So I think people will know who listened to my pod before don't know me. Mm. I did not have a rugby union upbringing. I grew up in Lee in Lancashire and everything was rugby league, basically. So I didn't really have a huge amount of relationship with rugby union other than thinking that it was called look at the state of that tackling, because that's what all my relatives said whenever it came on the television for any amount of time. So I didn't have a huge about, I kind of really discovered rugby union and games like this towards the end of the 80s, early 90s, when being English was a bit more of a comfortable thing to be, other than in this period, because 80s England was absolutely awful. But it wasn't something I'd use. And you don't, apart from when asked to do things like this, it's not an era you jump back to very, very quick, very often.
No.
I tend to hone straight into the 90s, like you do with lots of things, I suppose. That's when I was in my 20s. So I was 11. I was already very upset about my parents' divorce. So in a way, I'm glad I didn't have any awareness of this game going on at the time.
Yeah. It might have been the distraction you needed. It might have been something even worse.
Yes, it could have been. But no, it meant to be honest. It was fine. I just, you know, that's what it was, life I've dealt with it. It's okay. But it's at the but yeah, it was that's as much knowledge as I had. Sorry, Will.
Yeah.
No, not a problem. No. I mean, with that in mind, do you remember any of these players, or do you remember like a significant portion of them? Because there's a lot of them that we kind of weren't aware of.
I mean, a lot of the Wales team you hear on kind of reputation, or their voices still popping up on Scrum 5.
Or they've been in one of the many lists that Wales Online have done.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're in a Mark Orders list, which inexplicably starts with a quote from like... I mean, so Mark Orders did an article... This is a complete aside. Mark Orders did an article last week, which started with a Woody Allen joke, like a quote from a Woody... As Woody Allen once said, da-da-da-da-da, without any reference. That didn't come up again in the future of the article. Didn't really mean anything. Just completely pointed to reference to a nonce.
Yeah. As Woody Allen once said, you should marry your teenage children. Oh, that's gone to the baldest players from the 80s, yeah.
It was very close to that.
So in terms of ones that I remember, I remember the ones that were still around in the 90s, obviously. Mm. So from an England point of view, I remember John Webb. I remembered Rory Underwood. Everyone knew who Paul Rendell was, even though he'd kind of disappeared by the 90s, the judge, Paul Rendell. Brian Moore, obviously, who's still, you know, a sort of laureate of Twitter now, isn't he?
Yes, indeed.
Wade Dooley. I knew Nigel Redman. I remember Peter Winterbottom. Dean Richards, obviously. Richard Hill and Rob Andrew were on the bench, but we didn't see them. And everyone knows Gareth Chilcott because he's like this strange comedy character.
Yes.
From a Wales point of view, I remembered Richie Collins. And obviously the Moriarty brothers. Bob Norster, because he was always in the stands doing something, wasn't he? Even for years afterwards. Robert Jones and Jiffy, obviously. The only one I didn't really... From the back line of Wales, the only one I genuinely didn't remember was Bleddyn Bowen.
Mm. Sure.
He's been a player that I've really come to appreciate in this World Cup.
I've warmed to it.
Because
what
seems to happen in all of Wales' pool games is Jiffy runs up a blind alley, chucks it to Bowen, who somehow makes it work. Like, he is Jiffy's safety blanket. I just wish he was there on commentary as well, just so he could suddenly pull it round and say something.
Correct him. Every time. Every time Jiffy
actually, there aren't numbers, Jonathan.
There's letters.
Kevin Phillips, who's on the bench for Wales, I do remember as being one of the most psychotic players in Forneath in this period. Yeah. So I was a little bit upset that he didn't make an appearance at any time.
Yeah.
Especially as it was getting increasingly ill-tempered in the sort of middle third.
I think when I'm asking you, Lee, which players you remember, I think what I'm trying to dig down to is, you have any idea who the hell captain Mike Harrison was? Because we went into this podcast having not a clue.
No, none whatsoever. And I'll get into this in a bit more detail. I had no idea who Peter Williams was, and I became endlessly fascinated with it.
I think we've got quite a lot to discuss on Peter Williams as this game goes on. And somehow Mike Harrison, I mean, we've covered this before, but the captaincy landed on him completely by accident.
Yeah, it was literally people hold their hand. They had two players ruled out, and they went, "Who wants to be captain, lads?" And he was the only person to put his hand up. And somehow he ends up England captain for the first ever World Cup with his nickname Burglar Bill.
You've shared the commentary from the Australian, I think it was Australian, New Zealand commentary in your clip at the beginning of it. And obviously we had two links that we watched, and I watched 78 minutes of the English UK commentary.
Same here.
And then 2 minutes of I'll come into this. The commentator was fascinating to me, but we'll come into this later on.
Yes.
But he just referred to him as Mike Harrison of Wakefield. And at one point I wrote in my notes, "Poor Mike Harrison of Wakefield," about half an hour in. So, but again, we'll talk about that in a bit more detail.
Mike Harrison holds the Wakefield school's record for the quickest 100 metres, at least did in 1990.
Went to the same school as Mike Tyndall.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Queen Elizabeth Grammar School in Wakefield,
Does that make him royal as well? Is that how that works?
Probably for Yorkshire.
Close you get.
I'm glad you pointed out what you did a minute ago there, Lee, of the fact that we all watched the first 78 minutes with English commentary, English/Welsh commentary, I suppose, and then the last two, because basically that is on YouTube as a VHS recording, where it's fuzzy from the start, and it seems to have Batman commentating on it at the very start, saying, "Oh, God, there's a game between these two teams," and then suddenly it gets itself in shape and starts talking normally, and then for the last 2 minutes, it cuts out, and you think, "Thank fuck, it's over." And then you realise, when you pull up the team sheet and everything, that that wasn't the final score. And Lee, I'm afraid I had to send you a message this morning saying, I'm so sorry that we'll put you through this, but there is more of the game, so you might want to watch the last 2 minutes.
My favourite thing about that VHS recording is the cut from halftime, where clearly that old trick where they stop recording and then they continue recording, right? Mm. But the transition in it isn't clean. It seems to sound like someone screaming, "No!" Which, you know what, same. Yeah, that's exactly how I felt.
Who was the UK broadcast commentator? Do you know?
I have no idea.
I've never heard him before, and I couldn't work it out. But he was amazing.
I mean, you say he. I'm pretty sure it was a robot.
Absolutely zero emotion at all.
No,
apart from endlessly throwing shade without emotion.
So I know that on the sort of colour commentator was Gareth Davis, the ex-fly half.
President of the Welsh Rugby Union as well.
Indeed, yes, indeed. And I don't know who the main commentator was, but he spoke like this, and he'd say, "Oh, and it's now Mike Harrison has the ball, and he has kicked it. Not very good, actually, but I don't mind." And then the great thing is that then finishes, and you flick over to the other channel where they've got the Australian commentators on, and they're just saying, "Oh, boy, this game's shit, isn't it?"
But the funny thing is, he said exactly the same thing about four times, hadn't he?
Just
not changing his tone at all, no matter what was happening. My favourite thing about him was that every time Peter Williams kicked a touch, he went, "Peter Williams, left-footed." On the fifth time he did it, he said, "Peter Williams," and I went, "left-footed." And like a beat later, he went, "left-footed." And he said it as if like he had a fucking ring-tailed lemur for a foot. It was so unusual or something, you know. "Peter Williams, ringtail lemur. You know, it was fucking mad. It's like, yes, we know, and it's not that unusual.
He calls him Paul Williams twice as well. Just a bit of foreshadowing there for yes. you. But yeah, so you get to the Australian commentators. You watch them for about a minute and a half, and they commentate on how shit the game is like six times.
The amount I woke up when I turned over, I didn't realize I completely tuned out of watching the game. The moment I threw over, I was like, I'd have loved
watching this if I'd been given the other link first.
I would have enjoyed it a lot more. I've got an 18-second clip that I'm about to play of them.
Okay. Okay, you've thrown off before my favourite thing, which is they then throw over to the anchor, the host in the studio, who adds this.
It was hardly worth holding up the network news for, really. 16-3 Wales now to play the All Blacks at Ballymore in Brisbane this Sunday. Highlights, if we can find it.
And look, I know we've skipped to the end here, which, to be honest, I wish you could have done when watching it. But we've regularly talked about, they're showing network news after the rugby. But this time, like, everyone was praying for network news.
They just wanted that news on, man. They wanted to know what was happening in Melbourne.
Yeah, because, and even, I think as England had their last attack, because they before the thing that happened at the end. They were almost sort of like going, and now they're just shittily flinging it across the back line like a load of shit. It was like, it was almost like that was the entire tone of the thing. It was amazing.
I wish I'd watched them clearly tear into this from quite early on, because
the energy levels was complete opposite, wasn't it? And usually, we have all complained before about when you flick on BT Sport and Austin Healey's talking about how shit the game is. But sure. I was longing for that this time round.
Yeah. I mean, there's a quote, great quote from John Devereaux when asked about this game a few years later, or about 20 years later, he was asked about this game as like one of his defining moments in his career. Mm-hmm. And the quote, he said, "It was a shitty game, but we beat them."
Pithy.
Yeah. You know what? I think that does it. I think that kind of sums it up from a world perspective.
Look, we're trying so hard to wrap this episode up 20 minutes in, aren't we? So, should we look at the teams?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Where do you want to start?
I'll tell you what. There was a lot of news that was being held up. Australia called an election 2 days earlier, and they held the news up for this.
It's just as well there was a try at the end, I'll say that much.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there's one big... Should we look at the Welsh team? Because there's one really, really notable change, right? There's one really, really notable man coming in for his international debut. Mm. And that is, of course... I don't know if I did, like, I need to be copyright struck, but I figured having Leon...
The audio didn't go through
that. That didn't go through.
It did not.
But a tight head prop for Wales is one Dai Young.
Oh, yes.
Can you hear... No, okay, never mind.
Vaguely.
It didn't work. Okay, I played the song from the...
Listeners will have to play Dai Young by Dio Hero Black Sabbath to fill in that gap there. Yeah.
It took me a surprising amount of time to find that.
Pulled over from Western suburbs. We were just hanging around for the summer, playing a bit of rugby, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, this is so... Basically, Dai Young was on his gap year. Like, he'd gone as, like, a trip out to go and, you know... live in Australia for a few months, was playing, as you say, in the suburbs, and gets called up out of nowhere. So him and Richard Webster both get called up, kind of from almost nothing. There is a remarkable quote from Clive Rowlands, the manager, talking of Dai Young arriving. Dai Young was 19 as well at this point.
Wow.
Like 19-year-old
tight head prop. That's exceptionally young.
Who gets called up because he's nearby and he had a couple of injuries.
Geography too.
Yeah, the Tom Court gambit. So Clive Rowlands said, "We had a few injuries, so I told the union, we're going to get two new players in. Dai Young and Richard Webster, they're both playing up in Canberra. How do you know that?" they asked. "My son, Dewey, had told me about them." And So literally, they got called up because his son went, oh, there's two Welsh lads playing nearby.
So essentially, they called him up because it's his son's mates.
I don't know if they knew them, but his son knew they were there.
Either that or his son's a pretty good scout.
I got a message to both of them to report to the Welsh squad immediately. And when they did, I thought two hobos turned up. They had holes in their trousers. They were wearing flip-flops. I'd never seen anything like it. They were like tramps. I remember saying to Ray Williams, do me a favour, Ray, get them down to a gentleman's outfitters, then a sports shop, and come back with a full new set of kit. When they came back, they looked tidy.
Do you think...
What a quote of its time.
I mean, yeah. Do you think that Dowie Rowlands was the guy who discovered Nick Tompkins and Bradley Roberts were Welsh as well?
He's been hanging around the union for far too long.
Yeah.
That guy sounds like Jimmy Hoffa in the Irishman. He's upset when the bloke turns up in shorts to the meeting. You know, comes to a meeting, you wear a suit. Not taking this seriously, you know. So that's even like, he called up to Wales. Well, I'll have to go buy a suit where I can rock up to play a rugby game.
I was like, it's that young, you know. I suppose he was 19-year-old. 19 then. We didn't know, but it feels like the only suit Dai Young would ever need didn't come with shorts.
Do you think this is the bit when the breaking glass bit where he sort of then went into full number ones? Because he's quite a dapper fella, Dai Young, on the key,
yeah,
isn't he? So I think maybe this was the point at which he learned his lesson good and was forever in full suit, whatever the weather after that.
But see, Dai Young is also a man, not to Adam Jones degrees, but clearly fond of a pair of shorts. Like, and I wonder if this is, I don't know, I find it very easy to imagine Dai Young turning up in flip-flops on his first day training. Especially if he's, you know, 19 and he's never left the valleys before, and now he's in Australia in the summer.
I mean, and then you call you up, he's saying, yeah, you know, I mean, I know that England were terrible there, but it was like, yeah, Aya, you're going to prop against Paul Rendell now.
Yeah.
It's quite a thing, isn't it? It shows you how just immensely good he was right from the off, basically.
Yeah.
He played quite well, by all accounts, Dai Young. Yeah. I think that scrum time, the first scrum, he actually managed to sort of do a decent job on Rendell, which is pretty unexpected, especially with the context of him being 19.
Yeah, it's frankly very impressive.
The scrums back then, I mean, you forget. I mean, obviously, you've been watching a lot more of this than me. So, but you do kind of gasp a bit in the way in which it comes together. It's like somebody knocks down two Jenga towers and it somehow falls together and forms a bungalow. You know, because it just goes whoosh, yeah, and then it's like set, isn't it? It's like a really strange rhythm to it, like falling in on itself, and somehow nobody dies.
So far, anyway. We've got more time to cover. And the other thing is, right, there are still lots of scrum resets. And that's the thing when people talk about how quickly the scrum, you know, set and how quickly things got going. Everyone forgets there were still just as many scrum resets, if not more.
Yeah, they just set them quicker because they didn't care about safety at that point, did they? They just cared about getting everybody in. I mean, it was fun to look at, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Whether it was efficient is a different story, but... Yeah. Should we look at the England team?
Mm. Sure, yeah. So, yeah. The lead-in to the England team, right? In between the pool stage and the quarterfinal, the RFU had booked with a full squad to go to a Hamilton Island resort. And just go to New Zealand before flying over to Australia for this game. Where, right, the team enjoyed swimming, sunbathing, paragliding, and water skiing. And when asked about this game, again, later along the lines, when kind of reminiscing for this, Yian Evans said the thing he most remembered about the England team was how kind of toned and tanned and bronzed they all looked when they turned up.
At first, when you said the Hamilton resort, I thought you meant like they'd sent them to watch Hamilton and then go enjoy themselves for a couple of days. But no, I remember Hamilton.
Neither of those things, you know, it seems strange that's what they were doing rather than working on backs moves, because it looks like that's what they should have been doing, really, having witnessed this game. So
we'll come on to it, but one backline move that I think they really should have learned is give it to Rory Underwood, and they really struggled with that one.
It's funny.
I think Yian Evans did a reasonable job on him.
Yeah.
Apart from a couple of notable moments, to be fair.
Yeah.
Yian Evans was about the only player in this game that made me not regret having eyes.
Yeah, I mean, there was a handful, and I'll level with you. I don't think any of them were English.
I've been trying to think about when we get to the end, and I've got to try and say something good about England where I was going to pull that from, but we'll come to that later on, I guess.
Yeah, you've got an hour to think. The thing is, because I've gone through this whole World Cup essentially just hating this Welsh team and just like, you know, like I would like to say that I'm as big a Wales fan as you'll come across, but when I've watched this World Cup, I've almost wanted them to lose every game because they're so shit. And yet they're the second shittest team in this game.
It's amazing the power Jiffy can have.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Jiffy is a huge part of it. And like, Jiffy has much, you think like, Jiffy, you are good, but you are shit as well. Like, great pair of feet, right?
Well, like, is Jiffy good? Because, I mean, he's an incredibly talented player, right?
Talented,
but the thing I've noticed watching him in this World Cup, watching full matches, is what he seems to do is he basically runs up a blind alley. He runs, like, into a disaster zone, like, makes a terrible decision. Yeah. And then he's just, like, athletic and good enough to get himself out of it.
Yeah.
And people only remember his kind of, like, them saying his nickname was the Neath Houdini. Because, you know, it's exactly the same thing. He puts himself in a disaster, in a trap, and then somehow gets his way out of it. But you know what? There are plenty of tens who don't end up in traps all the time.
That's it. Like, Jiffy's rugby brain is, frankly, very substandard.
Yeah.
His feet are world class. Like, absolutely, like, excellent sidestepper and really, really fast runner.
He's the rugby equivalent of Saul Goodman. He just keeps throwing himself into dangerous situations and somehow getting out of it.
There's a reason why when he went to league, he ended up mostly being a fullback and a centre.
Yeah.
They didn't give him... I mean, he did play standoff, but it wasn't where he played his international rugby league and stuff because of it. I think because of what you said, all of his talent was in exactly what you just said. The fact that he the pace, the step, the way he could step off both feet at top speed. You know, it was remarkable.
Yeah,
there was one moment in this game was a perfect illustration of what you just said, where he took the ball off a line out. He had it came to him from Rob Jones. He had time to kick. He decided not to. He stepped the defender coming to him, ran back towards the line out as obviously a wall of white came towards him, and then realized he had to kick anyway, just in a much worse position and hurried. It was what was the point of this?
But it looks pretty.
Yeah, sorry, we're still on the teams.
Go on.
I think we're done with the teams, Lee. Yeah.
I think kicking generally in this, it seemed like the optimum time to kick in 1987 was when you were in a promising position just outside the 22 in possession of the ball. The option was always, I'll just lump this up like in front of the post and see what happens. When it's like you've got an entire team outside you, you've got your pack just there sort of thing. And it was the most bizarre... Obviously, very clearly coached by everybody. Yeah. But as soon as you get there, just hump it up in the air.
The very first thing that happens in the game is England get a line out and Peter Williams sticks the ball miles in the air. And you can simultaneously hear 15 Welsh voices all shout, "Yours!" As suddenly the ball descends to the floor, thumps off the floor, bounces miles in the air. And Bledham Bowen is then there thinking like, oh, all right, never mind. I'll deal with this. I'm the responsible one. And as the ball bounces back down towards him, he still somehow drops it. And it's like, Jesus,
John
Devereux,
like, bats it forward.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Volleyball
style. It's a really impressive knock on. And the referee somehow sees that as a 22 dropout, which is funny enough in itself.
We have two 22 dropouts in the first minute of this game.
It's mental. The one that I love is that there's one where you don't actually get to see the dropout. You just see that the ball has been somehow twatted downfield because there is a line out. Is now taking place in the opposition 10-metre line. And the commentator says it was returned with some interest, which can't really be the case because they don't make it back to halfway.
The ref, by the way.
Oh, Jesus.
What's his name? I mean, René something?
Hawkois.
Yes. And it's just the body popping, in mid-80s body popping that he's doing. When giving signals that nobody really understands, but the flourish of them is quite something else.
It is proper thriller era refereeing, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. Yeah, he had to go ow as he puts his hand up or something, but it's amazing. Yeah.
There is one point like in the second half where the commentator slightly starts to develop a personality and says like, oh yeah, this referee's hand signals are really confusing. And that's, you know, that's the first opinion he has in the whole game. And you think, oh, Jesus, get off the fence, pal.
But I will say, in the opening minutes as well, one thing that I did like is that there's not really a day goes by that I don't miss dummying off the back of rooks. Rob Jones does a fucking world a year to win a penalty for Wales. And honestly, I just think we should just bring it back. I think defences are already having too easy a time. I think I'm absolutely all for that law variation coming back. But it was wonderful to see.
And the amount of times he gets away with it, or the referee just goes, yeah, right, you can have that.
And plays full for it every single time as well. I don't think I've ever seen somebody call another Skarov's bluff.
With just how theatrical it is all the time.
Yeah.
Thing is, what you realise though with that is that every pass then is theatrical. Like a scrum, the scrum half picks it up off Harding, the England scrum half, picks the ball up off the back of the scrum, what's effectively a kind of 9-8-14 type move. And he's got to pass it about a metre and a half to Dean Richards. And it's still the full hold the ball like a submarine, arm out, rocking motion, fling it, spin pass. And it's like, it's literally, you could just literally just dolly it up with one hand to him. But everything's this very theatrically coached, old school, flailing, heavy cotton-armed windmill of a thing every time you pass the ball. So I think that's why the ridiculously elaborate dummying somehow works, I think.
I will add, it's very strong of you to refer to Richard Harding as a scrum half.
Yeah.
Well, that's like the one thing from the England team is that Richard Hill, not that one, and Rob Andrew, yes, that one, have been preferred. Well, they've been left on the bench, having probably been the better two, like halfback pairing England have had in this World Cup.
Yeah.
And instead, they put in Richard Harding and Peter Williams as their halfbacks. And that certainly was a choice they could have made.
Peter Williams of Oral, born in Wigan, so that got my attention going.
Yeah.
Dad played prop for Clonetley.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Four caps, 0 points.
No.
He's a fly half. Four caps, 0 points. That's the first nugget of fascination with Peter Williams I will leave you with.
And to put that on a bit of a cliffhanger, we'll touch on this in a little bit. But it's not like he never attempts points, is it?
Mm.
Just going to leave that cliffhanger there for the time being.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Well, going back to your point about the ball flying along, people shouting, "Your man," going back to 1987 and I used to live in it was an estate built in the 60s, which was a lot of semi-detached houses, you know, that those kind.
There
was a bit, my mate lived in the bit where there was two gable ends and a driveway. And you remember, you know, the rubber power balls that we used to have as kids? It used to, the little rubber balls.
We
used to go into his drive in that bit and then fling the ball as hard as you could. It'd ping and pang and pong off all the walls, and you'd be like ducking it. It was like funny. That was basically the ball this entire game. It was like it was basically a solid rock of rubber that we were pinging against a 60s semi-detached gable end, but it was coming off the players. It was incredible how many different angles it could pop out too fast from in the wrong direction. It was staggering right from the off.
And the amount of very simple passes that should be going to hand that somehow result in the ball like catapulting on the opposition 22.
Yeah, unbelievable.
It did feel completely randomised. And like, to half skip ahead, the first try in the game scored by Gareth Roberts is exactly that. The England have a put into a scrum 5 metres from their own try line, get absolutely murdered, and then the ball just kind of like explodes and kind of randomizes, and just it's somewhere on the try line because it's popped out like it's been sent into the ether, and then Gareth Roberts kind of sees a bit of the ball that's you know, the remnants of the ball that's just exploded, and grounds it, and technically that's a try.
That try, though, that was, you go back to Jiffy, that was the arrival of Jiffy, wasn't it? Round about, was it 28 minutes or something? It was like, he was like, I'm going to have a run now. Because it had just been fucking dreck for like 20 odd minutes. And then he decides to go, oh shit, oh he's in. He's back. And then it ping pong, and somehow went over. But it was, yeah, that was kind of his arrival. But before that, I did love the commentary of Paul Thorburn lined his kick up. And the commentator went, Thorburn, not a difficult kick. And he shanked it about 2 kilometers wide from just right. Everything about this game, every motion and every person lacked proficiency in every way whatsoever. Anything that people were asked to do, for the most part, had zero proficiency to it. It was, in a way, it was morbidly beautiful.
It's a terrible day for goal kicking in general. Oh, like there's a one Jonathan Webb lines up where. I kind of skipped forward a bit while I was kind of working for it.
We were all doing that, weren't we? Let's be honest.
And as I'm skipping forward, I kind of go like, wait a second, how did the ball end up there? And I then have to rewind and watch the kick again because it lines up, it ends up closer to the corner flag than the posts. And he is kicking from halfway between them. He managed to kick it the wrong side of him. And I think there's a gust of wind, but you know, it's still that, some impressive work.
My favourite one is when Jiffy attempts to drop goal and it lands perfectly in touch 5 metres from the goal line. It ends up being a brilliant kick into touch, but he was aiming to get it through the uprights.
That's the thing, it puts Webb under so much pressure that he puts the ball out 5 metres out.
It's
like peak Dan Parks kicking, except he's aiming to nail a drop goal.
Absolutely. And like, not only would that require the ball going a good 10 metres further, considering it was bouncing well before the goal line in order for Webb to field it, but also, let's think, how wide's a rugby pitch? However wide a rugby pitch is, half of that to the bloody left.
And yet that was the second worst drop goal attempt of this game.
Are we going to go there?
Let's do it. Sure. Because let's have a little shit drop goal section.
It made me think, right, last time we had Lee on the podcast, we put you through watching Toby Flood playing centre for England, receiving the ball about 40 metres out and just randomly sticking his foot on the ball and it bouncing into the French 22 and, you know, it being grounded or whatever. And basically, it was a dog shit kick, right? And somehow, that is now the third worst drop goal attempt we've put you through on this podcast, Lee.
Yes. At least with the Flood one, you could say that was always a fucking daft idea. That was never, but do you know what I mean? Because of where it was from. Whereas back to our friend Peter Williams, who's in a perfectly serviceable position, and because he's left-footed, it was on the correct side for him as well. And yeah, I don't know if you want to describe what happened. Will.
It doesn't reach his body height.
The commentator described it as a grass cutter, which I think is spot on.
That is good.
That was after he said it was either dreadful or dismal. He kind of then moved on to, I better kind of be a bit more flowery about this. Yeah, grass. Because before that, he said a dreadful attempt there from Peter Williams. Can I talk about Peter Williams again?
Please, go for it.
He's left-footed.
The drop goal is ridiculous. Played for Oral, left-footed. And I thought, I wonder what happened to him. Because you know what I'm like. I'm like, why is he playing rugby union anyway?
Sure.
I want to go and find out what's happened here. Well, it turns out he signed for Salford in 1989 and actually played 100-odd games for Salford. 103 games at centre and scored 27 tries. Played for Wales Rugby League and played for Great Britain twice Rugby League.
Okay.
So there's a website called the Rugby League Project, which is like kind of a patron and charity, get like crowdfunding thing, where they're trying to actually get a huge database of rugby league history. Okay, they're also trying to combine it with an oral history. So you have all these stats, and then they ask
an
you
oral history or an oral history.
A what? Sorry,
an oral history or an oral history.
Oh, no, yeah, well, that might be another website, but an oral history. So it asks you to submit memories of players.
Oh,
and
okay.
They put that on their page as well. And what?
Oh,
you...
nice.
So obviously you can imagine some of the bigger names in rugby league. You've got a lot of this stuff, but Peter Williams doesn't have many. Now, this isn't funny,
surprise me, really. Okay.
However, you have to wonder why somebody would submit this to the Rugby League project page about Peter Williams, right? So there's a section at the bottom, all his stats, a section of your say, Maria submitted in 2011. I met Peter many years ago at the Willows Rugby Club. He was an absolute gentleman. So far, so nice, right? Lovely. At the time, I was in a very abusive relationship, says Maria.
Oh, no.
Sorry, okay.
It's not funny, but I've always wondered what happened to the charming gentleman I met in 1989. I now live just outside London. And my boys just started playing rugby at Henley-on-Thames, says Maria. That was her submission to Peter Williams' Rugby League project page. Dave's submission also in 2011 says, Peter was a convert from Union. Yes, he was. We've just established that, Dave. He joined Salford after the 87 World Cup, which explains his only four games, I guess, where he played standoff in preference to his more famous teammate, Rob Andrew. Yes. Dave concludes, bet Peter's amused by the mess Andrew is making of the RFU.
if only those... Peter Williams had ended up in charge of the Rugby League organisation.
Indeed.
The Rugby Football League.
Yeah, they could have had like daggers across codes, even more so.
We could have had like a generation-spanning epic movie about the two of their rivalry. prestige for rugby.
What we learn is that Peter Williams wasn't particularly memorable in either code. I think is what we conclude.
Yeah. Like, literally, in both of those, at some point, they kind of forget what they're actually talking about and go on a separate tangent and, like, have a sentence that stands out in there.
I mean, poor Maria obviously needed to get some of this out of her system. I wonder about how many times she's just randomly submitted things to websites with that inserted in the middle, sort of in quite a clanging way, bless her.
Can you check for other memories by Maria?
Yeah.
Are they all like this?
I'm going to go through a number of Salford players from that period and see if she's just saying that about all of them.
She talks about how Rangi Chase reminds her of her parents' divorce.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, that was... Yeah, so that's the rabbit hole Peter Williams took me down when I was supposed to be watching this rugby game.
The fact he went on to win caps for Wales in rugby league is enough.
Mm.
To then end up in the fact that he single-handedly cured Maria. Remarkable.
It's amazing what being left-footed can do for you.
I also want to mention Richard Harding, his halfback partner, who...
If we must.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll get onto him as his performance. But, right, his Wikipedia page refers to him as having two different nicknames, does not explain either of them. In school, he was known as Gilbert. But in university, where he went to Cambridge, because, of course, he's, you know, rugby union, isn't it?
He's different. Known as Maria.
He was known as Corky. Can't tell you either.
Gilbert might be because of the rugby ball, I guess.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But whatever it was, it sounds like great banter. Anyway.
So Richard Harding, after this, right, is named captain for England's tour of Fiji.
Jesus Christ.
And then never plays with them again.
Wow.
He was the fourth Bristol player to have a captain.
Did they just leave him behind on Fiji?
They just dropped him there. He's waiting to get picked up. Jamie Wall almost ran into him last week.
I reckon they named him as captain just so he would fly out just for a tour that didn't actually happen. So, you're captain, you need to go out there. You need to make your own way, though. For some media stuff that you have to do early.
Wandering around Suva, boiling in an RFU suit, trying to figure out what's going on.
He's still going.
There's a lot of, like, references to his own great moments on his Wikipedia page, which, again, tells me he edited this himself.
Oh, yes.
From an internet cafe in Suva.
He's apparently now an estate agent.
Oh, okay.
You know. So
I hope he's better as an estate agent than he is a scrum half. When he turns up, you go, oh, it's Corky, the estate agent.
Super's proudest. Yeah. He's actually the guy who sold Ben Ryan his hat on the beach.
He's like that Japanese soldier they still found in the jungles for 40 years after the war had finished. He still thinks he's got a game on at 3 o'clock and will be convinced that the team isn't coming at some point.
That's why England don't play games in the South Pacific, just in case they bump into him.
They're trying to get Dean Richards to go over as his senior officer to tell him it's actually over, but he won't go. He can't. He's not doing it.
He's carrying on the longest warm-up of all time.
And his box kicks are still terrible, even after 25 years try. No, 35 years try.
Like, even the All Blacks are worried that if they go over and play a game in Suva, he'll end up being their starting nine. It's horrible. I mean, he's qualified for Fiji now, I suppose, on residency. So,
yeah.
Draw your own conclusion.
So I've completely lost track of where we are in the game.
There's a point where Anthony Buchanan gets some weird cream rubbed on his back.
Nice. Okay.
Speaking of injuries as well, I did love the fact that they zoomed right in on Blevin Bowen's hamstring strapping at the beginning. Yeah. He has a strap on his hamstring and it just looks like it's the worst, most rudimentary thing you've ever seen in your life. And you just look at it, how's that helping at all?
They say, very heavily strapped up and it is one bit of tape.
Yeah,
like literally in the middle of his thigh. It's like, did they literally zero it down to it's that bit of the hamstring that he's strapping?
I looked at that bit. And I thought, how on earth is that helping your hamstring in the slightest?
He seemed to do all right because he was actually okay, as you said earlier.
Yeah. Okay. There's also a point where Gareth Roberts goes down injured. Then stood next to him is Jiffy holding Roberts' boot and relacing it. And I can't quite figure it out, but they're having a little chat with the referee while Jiffy is just doing something to Gareth Roberts' boot. Very confusing
stuff.
He
picks it up and he tries to put it back on him. And then kind of goes, oh, right, okay. But, in the age of HIAs and everything we know now about concussion, Gareth Roberts should not have been on the pitch.
No.
That was bad. He was properly out of it. It was a lot like Jesse Krull at the weekend now, where you could tell instantly he didn't know where he was. Yeah.
No, he shouldn't have been playing. You're right.
Towards the end of the half, general point, and I'm sure you've probably reflected on this in other episodes, thank Christ they brought lifting in.
Yes.
Good God. Yeah. But on the more simple point, poor Mike Harrison of Wakefield, right? He spent most of the first half dropping the ball and generally having a mare. Then gets a decent run going at one point and manages to welly the ball. As he attempts to chip it over Paul Thorburn, he wellies it straight into Paul Thorburn's fizzog, full on in the face. And it springs forward in that explosive way the ball was doing. And then about three people try to fly hack it, and it goes in about four different directions. That might be given in the second half, actually.
No, it's a remarkable bit of work, because you do have the moment of going, oh, good on Mike Harrison. I'm glad he's got... Okay. There we go. It was coming.
And then basically, his frustration is taken out on Jiffy's head.
Yeah.
Jiffy manages to gather this nightmare fly hacking stuff. He just flies in and lamps in one full windpipe job across the head.
The great thing is he goes out of his way to make the tackle high. Mm. He kind of jumps around to grab the back of his neck like a vampire.
Was that on Jiffy, was it?
That was on Jiffy, yeah.
Yeah. Because there was a part of me thinking he's had it coming.
Yeah, unfortunately he left his windpipe still working.
Yes. Imagine Jiffy saying numbers, one of those things you have to press on your throat to speak that people are in that accent. Numbers. But it's however, I will say later on, Richard Moriarty, you never forget, does nearly dislodge Harrison's head from his shoulders in the second half later on. Tackle.
Yeah. Just another day of the job.
Standard Moriarty stuff, isn't it?
Indeed.
Or Dick Moriarty, at least 4 minutes. Calling him, which makes him sound ludicrous.
There's two more points I think I got in the first half. One of them is that Ian Evans makes his break from Jiffy getting charged down, which is bullshit. And he goes half the length of the field, and I thought he was going to score for a moment.
As I say, Ian Evans is great fun. He is absolutely rapid. Having him against Underhill as probably the two quickest players in the tournament, or certainly up there, is a lot of fun, having the two of them constantly trying to just outpace each other. Whenever Yayan gets a run, it is suddenly the game is worth watching for 40 seconds.
Yep. Yeah. The other thing I have from the first half is there's a point where Jonathan Webb passes to himself, or passes to nobody, and instead of going and diving on the loose ball, he just stands there and just leaves it for a Welsh player to dive on instead.
It spoke a lot to the entire aura of this. But The thing I noticed which got me thinking is that at one point there's an advertising board in the background which says Stein Lager voted world's best lager. Yeah. Exclamation mark. And have you covered this before?
I mean, it's come up in passing.
We've brought up a lot of
sponsorship deals involved in this World Cup with Stein Lager.
Yes.
And it just got me thinking, how does one conduct such a vote in 1987 that's in any way legitimate?
It's a very good question.
How is this done? Is it like, did they just ask the people of New Zealand, do you think this is the best lager in the world? Like when Saddam Hussein on that referendum, well, he should still be president before he died, you know? My mind just boggled about how on earth. I mean, it's hard enough. I mean, now with the internet and the like, but you know,
but it's
it just made me think how are these things? And you know, what's your cross? Is it a cross sample? Is it a poll? Is it, you know? I went off on a complete. This shows you again the quality of the rugby was outstanding because my brain was off on the polling methodology of the Stein Lager vote.
I mean, you have a point, though, because it doesn't mean that it won the majority vote. It just meant at least one person voted it as
such.
Oh,
true.
Yes,
true.
It meant there was one or two people said, would you say this is the best lager in the world? And one of them says yes. They can use the words voted best lager in the world.
Yeah.
And we know advertising standards was not as strict back then, especially not in New Zealand. We've watched some of the adverts they broadcast back on these games.
But 7 billion people didn't vote for Stein Lager being the best of the world. Ah, yes, but you're assuming that they wouldn't have done had they been polled.
We also, speaking of like sponsors, every game, especially now we're getting into the bigger games, I am looking for the Maserati in the corner of the pitch, and it is not there today. The Mazda, the Mazda in the corner of the pitch.
Yes.
Has been given out to the best driver of the tournament. And tell you what, right, with how bad two of the Welsh tries are, I did wonder whether they're going to just take the car away from the players. Like, is Gareth Roberts just going to lose his car as a result of how bad his try was?
The Mazda gets driven further and further away the longer they watch Wales play rugby.
Also, I mean, I will say about, as usual, an oasis of quality, even if it was misplaced throughout the entirety of this, was watching Robert Jones pass the ball.
Yes.
Which is just something you can never tire of watching in any way, shape, or form. However, he's so enamoured with passing the ball. I don't know if it's his decision, but he makes Jiffy line up about 13 miles behind him for every kick. I think just so he can show how beautifully executed his pass is. At one point, John Devere is offside. So, well, of course he was offside because Jiffy was literally 500 metres behind him when the ball was passed to him. So no wonder he ran offside. Some of the decisions around the setups and the depth that people stand at, man.
Yeah.
It's just, so what do you, I know it wasn't as hard to break defences down then, etc. But no wonder they must have been fucking, the minds must have been blown when Walter Little turned up and the like, stood a bit closer. Do you know what I mean? It's absolutely incredible.
It would have really helped if Wales learned the offside from kick rule at some point before this quarterfinal.
Yes. There's a particularly egregious one for Richie Collins in the second half, isn't there?
Oh.
I was going to say, do you want to go into that?
I mean, it's just bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
He actually tries his very best not to be offside until, in the end, the ball's just too close and he can't resist actually just getting involved. But again, he doesn't catch it. As usual, he just punches it in a random direction, which and the ref does a weird, jerky movement nobody understands, and somehow it's an England penalty. I mean, I think by this point of the first half, and certainly by the time I get off to, were you keeping track of Wales's penalty count at any point?
It's ridiculous, isn't it? I think they throw it up at one point. It's like 16 penalties, Wales, 2 England.
Yes.
You're like, hold on. How is that also the score?
Yes. I'm pretty sure they were on 20 by the end of this game, Wales.
They probably were. It's ridiculous. And yet England could just do nothing with it.
I mean, we probably need to pause to talk about just how absolutely appalling England were at everything they attempted.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Kicks for touch were terrible. Drop goals are terrible. You've mentioned John Webb's unbelievable shanking of a kick.
Mm, yeah.
I think if you're going to look for small bright lights in the darkness, he was actually okay, John Webb, I thought, in some of the stuff he was at least trying to do. No pass was too simple to ruin.
No
alignment was too, you know, simple to not do correctly in the back line. No, it was just unbelievable. And they just kept trying no matter how much it kept going wrong by flinging it, they just kept doing it. It was just, why do you keep doing this? Peter Williams is not your man to shape this. The scrum half's taken 5 minutes to get it out of anything anyway. Just please, just give it to Wade Dooley or something and let him have it for at least 12 minutes. Tell him what he does with it.
That was the other, like, if you're picking a bright spark in this England performance, is, do you know what? Wade Dooley was a prick and that was his job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's very good at that, isn't he?
Like, he has done what has been asked of him. You know, if you're to line it up, he has done exactly that.
There's a point where Mike Harrison gets put into touch and the referee penalises him for it. Clearly he's so sick of England shit.
And how is Nigel Redmond only 23 years old?
What? No way. No way. I figured he was like 38 and still getting away with it.
There's another broader question here is, why were so many people bald back then? But I think I've realised it's because nobody did the full shave, did they, when they were bald? Nobody went, oh, shit. It was perfectly acceptable to have this randomised thatch of hair looped around the sides of your head back then, which instantly made you look about 46, even when you were 23.
But everyone had lost their hair by, I don't know. I'd lose my hair if I was playing in this England team, so...
Do
you think it was
if Richard Harding was a halfback, then, you know, that would have aged me about 50 years, so...
An entire like diet of like having a chip pan on the go and crispy pancakes just actually made everybody lose their hair in the 80s and the 70s. I don't even think of, but yeah, unbelievably, like everyone's just got proper like middle-aged dad geography teacher hair, and yet they're athletes playing at the top level of a game. Not a professional game, admittedly, but even so.
Jiffy's hair, man. Jiffy's hair. Just... another extraordinary thing about I got really angry at one point. I almost kind of lost my shit over I've listened to so many probably hours over my life collectively of Jonathan Davis, not that the other one, the old one, talking about how angry he is about pointless kicking, and then watching him pointlessly kick the ball away so often,
but
so
genuinely
often,
I know it's a stupid
aimless
thing for us as three people who don't know how to play rugby,
sure,
sat in a room. I know it's pointless for us all to say this, but I just genuinely think he does not understand the philosophy of kicking in rugby.
But I think also it's before people have kind of worked
it's
that
before
out.
Any, like, nobody did at this point. But it genuinely really frustrates me about Jiffy in particular because of the context.
Oh, you mean
of
Jiffy nowadays?
To a lesser extent.
That's the thing, it's because I've listened to him complain about good kicks so often.
Yeah.
The watching him kick badly hurts more.
That's it.
Than,
because,
like, Peter Williams, you know, if he kicks badly, I'm like, okay, good on
you.
Yeah,
yeah.
Good on you. You solved
Maria's
problem.
Whereas
Jiffy
has such an ego about him that, like, even still, that is, oh, I don't know. I'm just sick of Jiffy.
His touch finding was pretty decent, Jiffy.
He was.
In a way, he still clings on to now. Like, all of them knobheads cling on to now. But somehow a spiral touch finder beautifully executed that bounces in touch 5 metres from the line is the only good kick in any form of rugby. It's
even
just
if you're
completely
trying to drop
infantile. You know, that whole thing around, you know, people used to, when Phil Bennett died, rest his soul, Mark Ring, who was on the bench in this game, was all over Twitter talking again about how he wasted, you know, it just dropped into touch and that's what made him amazing. Said, yeah, but if most people tried that, most of them wouldn't and they'd be dropped. Do you know what I mean? It's like they've got no concept of percentages or playing to any kind of strategy. It's just, anyway, we could go.
Yeah.
And and it's not, like you said, the frustrating thing is, it's not even like you can come back here and go, oh, yes, look how brilliant all this kicking was. But then I understand why you're so fucking in love with it. You know, it's not sorry, I'm swearing all over the place here.
Please, continue.
You're from the Blood and Mud podcast.
Just, your house, your rules.
Sweary pipe bomb of rugby knowledge.
Indeed. I reckon that generally our cap is that we like to have about 90% as much swearing as Blood and Mud. You know, that's fair.
That's right then. I'll carry on. I have actually cut it back. So I'll let loose for this second half report.
Yeah, yeah. Please do. Mate, we've still got Josh yet to come on this series. Don't you worry.
At
one point towards the end of the first half as well, John Devereux goes for an interception with his head and he headers the ball into touch when trying to intercept it. Just a moment I enjoyed from the first half.
Yeah, I like that.
He is noticeably stronger than everybody else, Sean Dembrowski.
It is
really noticeable. Before, I mean, I knew he was strong in league, but it's a different conditioning thing, even in the 90s. But
sure.
He is noticeably a much stronger player than everybody else. And poor Salmon in the England midfield, he was just...
Poor
pair of them, really. Kevin Sims is completely anonymous. He probably just on the end of a ball bouncing off his head three times.
The Welsh player from this World Cup that it is easiest to find quotes of them talking about it is Mark Ring. Like, there's a lot of Mark Ring chatting about this World Cup, which is
I should have been
unsurprising
in each of these moments that happened.
I should have won that Mazda. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, he brings up how strong John Devereux was a lot. It keeps coming up every interview I read from him about this World Cup.
He lost a few wrestling matches with him in training. They didn't train, did they? But, you know, fill in the blanks.
Also, did we see Dai Young's moustache in this game?
Oh, yes.
This vintage... Oh, glorious.
Certainly did.
Absolutely glorious. Bring it back.
Vintage grown to get served in the offie when you're 17.
Yes. Moustache,
that is.
I reckon he did his research on the referee and tried his best to look as much like him as possible to try and win him over.
Can we have a moment to talk about the referee, by the way?
Yes, Rennie absolutely. Courcois,
the French referee. I don't think I understood a single decision he made over the game.
There's one point where he just sees a ruck, does a really long blow of the whistle, and then just puts his thumbs up. It's like a signal for what he's doing. He doesn't say penalty one way or the other, scrum one way. He just puts his thumbs up, and the player's like, okay, what do you want us to do with that, mate? And then eventually England have a penalty.
He does a knock-on movement at one point in a ruck, but it's a Wales penalty. He signals for an England knock-on, and then it's a Wales penalty. And even like Jiffy, you can see Jiffy looking a bit quizzically at him as the ball's being passed to him to kick to touch.
There's one time where the ball is about to be played out the ruck by Rob Jones and he just blows up and awards Wales a scrum. We're already there. We've already got this far, mate.
But I mean, my theory on this is similar to, because we kind of discussed this with Jamie Wall last week, but all three referees that they had in this tournament are either English or Welsh. You've got Clive Norling, Derek Bevan and Roger Quittenden are the only three referees we've really seen all tournament. And now Wales are playing England. You can't get one of them to ref. So they've clearly just dragged a French bloke off the street and gone, got a whistle. You need to go in there, do your best, pretend to know the rules and you'll be fine. Yeah.
This was one of two games he refereed at this World Cup and he's refereed two more at the next World Cup, which kind of makes you wonder why he was there if they're only going to be two games. But
he looks like a mime artist they found on some touring company, basically. Yeah.
Like a really budget mime artist.
Yeah.
And hence him not really understanding the signals he's doing, you know? Like, sometimes
how do you even start to decipher the knock-on situation in some of these little, you know, things that present themselves in this game? There's one point we think there were at least five knock-ons there and he's not given a single one. He's just said, there you go, lad.
You kind of feel lucky whenever he gives... Like, there's a point at which Mike Harrison drops a high ball in front of him, and I was genuinely surprised when he blew up for the scrum. Like, I was not expecting him to do it. He went on, after this, to referee the 1989 Lions test, with the second test, which is now referred to as maybe the most violent rugby match of all time.
Oh, wow.
So he was in charge of that. And then, right, in the same year, he was the linesman in the French Championship final, the kind of precursor to the top 14, right? In the final, in the 54th minute, the referee, Mr. Lamournier, went off with a broken leg and he took over.
How?
Is Callum Clark playing?
Like, second division in France, I can understand. Top 14, nah.
It was 1989, man. Like, anything goes then.
True, it's before TMOs were invented.
He went on to recover from his... Actually, I think that might be... Oh, no, yeah, okay. He somehow recovers from his broken leg, somehow. Yeah, people do recover from broken legs.
Yeah, I was going to say, did he go to the cave and feed you with Waisaki Nahola? Maybe Richard Harding was the guy who cured him. Yeah. I thought. Anyway, crack on.
He became the treasure of the French Rugby Union from 2000 to 2012, which, can you imagine how baffled everyone wanting money was? That, do you think that's why the union was in such shoddy shape for so long?
Did he agree to fund it? I think so. He put his little finger in the air and pointed at the window. I don't know. I think it was a yes.
And like, by the time he retired from being the French Rugby Federation's treasurer, right, he was 74. Like, this was him in his prime. This was him in his like late 30s, right? By the time he's nearing 80.
Wow.
And I've still got him in charge of all money in France.
It's a portion of all the money in the world.
Yep. So we know how that gets there.
Yep.
What through some take French off rugby guy. League. Don't get me started.
Yeah. There's a point as well where Adrian Hadley knees Jonathan Webb in the back and he penalises Webb for it.
Yeah.
It's all bit,
the referee position is like this entire game, really, because, and I mean this really, I watched this, right, and I wound some stuff back to have another look. It's very, very hard to understand anything about this game. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to understand. Well, we're going to come to Robert Jones's try in the second half, aren't we? Mm. It's all of a sudden, they go, oh, some play's broken out, but I don't understand how, why, or what's contributed to it, or what decisions have been made to make this happen. But something's just broken out somehow.
Yeah. I mean, I know this is like, I have thought a few times during this World Cup, I wish I was watching rugby league from this era, when at least you'd get some kind of structure, because the kind of loose
occasional tackles made
to,
as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Look at that tackle technique. The looseness of union, the kind of, you know, the fact, as we've talked about before, you can control possession, you can keep hold of the ball and so on. At this point, really didn't mean anything. Like, no one had worked that out. And so it ends up being stupidly loose. And as you say, like, if we look at the Robert Jones try, I've got no idea where it comes from. There's no build-up or anything. It just kind of comes out of somewhere.
All of a sudden, Blethyn Bowen is sort of free.
Yeah.
And
then Richie Collins bursts
through. Like, Richie Collins, as you were alluding to earlier, Lee, kind of just makes a living off being offside all the time and then accidentally finds himself in a brilliant supporting position and runs, like, 20 metres, tries this offload to Rob Jones, who just kind of hacks it on, sort of volleys it. And at that point, I kind of go, oh, wait, I know this try. Like, I've seen this on, like, VHS tape growing up. And, yeah, he beats Richard Harding to the ball, well done, and grounds it.
Richie Collins was also a Wales international basketball player.
What?
And you think he just never learned the difference between the two?
No.
And so he just took basketball positioning at all times.
Do you think he invited the ref with him?
I'm thinking he's like a proto Chris Ashton, like lurking ahead of play, ready to do a wonderful support move all the time. One thing I will say that the ref did understand was offside on the kicker, though.
Yeah.
He got them absolutely bang on. It's almost like he was very proud. That's the only thing he actually could understand and wanted to do it as much as he could. And Wales really helped him. So,
yeah, I mean, it's a well-taken try, I suppose. I kind of have written in my notes, Rob Jones scores a then nice with about 16 question marks try.
I think it was. When it finally broke out, there was a lot of heads-up decision-making that went on, wasn't there? And the fact that the ball spilled out was what fucking happens. And then Rob Jones in the typical bit of quick thinking, but God, he was a good player, man.
He was good.
Even in this
good.
Game, he wasn't really playing that well. He was still a kind of
towering. I found him one of the bearable players in this game.
I think so. Usually. I think he was,
yeah.
There's a point where he puts his kick on the money and like in the corner for Underwood to play it. And like even Rory Underwood couldn't get out of that position as like probably the strongest runner on the pitch. He was still forced into touch. And it was just really smart by Rob Jones. As I say, good is a strong word for any player who had any involvement in this game, but you know, he was certainly bearable.
Was that one moment in the second half? Sorry, go on.
No, you go on, please.
Yes.
A bit later on, though, talking about Underwood is when he actually finally gets away. And then you think, oh, shit, sort of thing, because the pace is back then. But again, Devra covers across very well. I think that's the one when Harrison is trying to run in support. That's the one Richard Moriarty, and he takes Harrison's head off. To bring it to to a stunning conclusion in more ways than one. Yeah.
It's what he's good at. You know, you've got to keep to your talents. Wade Dooley did it. Richard Moriarty can do it. Keep to the headings.
Indeed. Of course, Underwood makes a break and throws this really audacious overhead pass where you can see him thinking about it for about 4 seconds before he actually does it.
Mm.
It doesn't really work, but it looks very nice. So
you know what?
I'm fine with it.
You know what? Mike Harrison runs a really good support line. Doesn't matter that he knocks it on. You know, it's a good step forward for the England captain.
Yes, indeed.
Mike Harrison indeed of Wakefield to give him his full title.
Mike Harrison of Wakefield.
Yeah. Of course.
The quickest man in Oral.
I wrote down at one point, England are just like a shit Jaguares.
But where's Haguardo?
Yeah, exactly. Where is Haguardo? Yeah, just the constant lobbing of utter shit everywhere for no particular reason. Yeah.
There's that point
we could have had like Haguardo's father, who's just Haguardo with a moustache.
And like and sideburns.
I'm pretty sure he was playing blindside for England.
Well, playing blindside for England was one of the ones they talk about in hushed tones of how incredible he was, Peter Winterbottom, and he was fucking dog shit.
There's a great point where England get a free kick from a scrum or a line out. And, you know, the referee holds his arm up like, you know, in a bent fashion. And I think the players then just assume that probably means free kick, but we'll stick with it. We won't question it. We'll just try and get on with the game. And Peter Williams is thinking like, right, okay, I'm going to stick this in the air and, you know, we'll compete for it. Richard Harding, however, wrestles the ball from him, takes a quick tap, goes for an up and under, which goes about 15 metres to the left-hand side.
Yeah.
And I'd say probably about 0.5 meters forward. So it slightly goes behind him. And it's the worst kick he's done in a World Cup, which is saying a lot.
It's maybe the worst kick of the World Cup end up. It's very impressive.
And like we've seen kicks that go backwards in this World Cup.
This is one of them.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's really the crowning achievement on his day, you know, because up until then you're going like, oh, he's having a really difficult day, isn't he, Richard Harding? And then watching that moment, you go, oh, he's just dog shit. He's just...
I don't know why at some point in this half, Dean Richards just refused to allow the ball out of the scrum. You know, he kind of called for it, or he stood on his hands as he went to get it out. Because Richards was more than capable of holding that ball in there for 5 hours, if you let him, let him do it, and just jocking it between his feet. And I just don't, I'm very confused of how the forwards just didn't put an end to all this nonsense, really, and just say, no, we're having it. You don't get to make decisions anymore. You know,
and
if you try and put your hands in here, you're going to lose your fingers. So
that's it. Like,
your own players. Because there's a point at which you shouldn't be doing it anymore.
If you take this ball off me, I'll knock you out.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of knocked out, my favourite player of all time now, Peter Williams. Makes the very foolishly tries to tackle a large Moriarty at one point and ends up crumpled in a heap for at least 6 minutes.
Yeah. And still they don't bring on Rob Andrew. No, they've got an excuse.
I was very surprised when I did skip forward a bit when he was lying there and he thought, fucking, he's still on. But he's still like in the first half.
Rob Andrew then just really warms up like a man who knows there's cameras on him and thinking like, what do they usually do at this point?
A little trailer of things to come.
Yeah. And he does this little heel flicks and occasionally looks back to the camera like, oh, it's still on me. Yeah, it's still on me. Oh, I need to stretch slightly to the side. You know, and he looks extremely self-aware in his warming up.
Can I also... Sorry, I realised, like, a minute or so ago, I clicked back onto Richard Harding's Wikipedia page because I just wanted to check something while I was... And I've just come across, right, at the bottom of his Wikipedia page, there is a really, really long section on his career as an estate agent. I say really long. It's surprisingly long and goes into a lot of detail on one particular deal he did in 2008.
Oh.
In which it discusses how he basically bought a house, sold it again for a profit. But he sold...
That doesn't sound that groundbreaking.
It really doesn't. But it details, like, 60 grand of it was paid in cash and the rest in credit. The rest... as a deferred amount of what it goes into way too much detail on one deal he did, which lead me to wonder, was that either the most recent one when he did the deal, when he entered his Wikipedia page, or is this about all he's done? It then also says, personal life, Richard Harding has a wife, Angela, who partners him in business, and together they have two children.
And in the bedroom.
Normally it would say Harding or he or something, but it says Richard Harding has a wife, Angela.
I reckon that description sounds like somebody's trying to is trying to whistleblow without drawing any anonymously whistleblow via Wikipedia to the money laundering authorities. You know, there was 60,000. This was in cash. You know, nobody was quite sure where it came from.
They're just really hoping all the authorities are really religiously reading shits from our Wikipedia pages.
Let's just say it right now: Richard Harding washes money through property deals. That's what we concluded.
Do you think there's any insider trading information hid on Martin Roberts' Wikipedia page?
There's something to read into.
I've just opened his official website, richardharding.co.uk.
Oh.
And do you know what?
I haven't found anything. Is it GeoCities? Is it one of them?
It is quite... it does mention... Okay. Here is Richard Harding's description on the About Us section of his website, right?
Okay.
Richard Harding, the governor, the boss, the...
Good God.
The man Gilbert. Whose name is on our signage and above our door, the man we call Richard. With his kind and gentle nature, his genuine interest in people and their stories, and clearly an excellent nose for business, Richard is our key figure in our commander and one of many reasons why we all like working at Richard Harding so much. An original Bristol boy, Richard qualified for Cambridge University for a degree in land economy and a blue in rugby. His nifty long pass earned him a place at Bristol. His nifty long pass...
I guess it was nifty in the fact it was evasive of the 10 he was trying to hit.
Photos or it didn't happen.
Earned him several caps for England. Richard is too modest to tell you this.
Richard doesn't want you to watch any of his games.
I think Richard fucking wrote this on his website, pal. But you are spot on there, Lee. Richard doesn't mention this for a reason, in case you look him up and find out what kind of a player
Richard
he was.
Harding would like to say that £60,000 was found absolutely legitimately for that deal back in when.
Along with his wife Angela, they established Richard Harding Estate Agents in 1996. Brackets, this origin story is epic and thrilling, but alas, we do not have the space for it here. Richard lives with Angela and their dog Molly in Redland, and in his spare time, brackets, if Angela can ever get him out of the office, which, just casual joke about their marital troubles.
Zinger there.
He enjoys walking. Oh, there's a full stop. All then
blind alleys.
Any
it
kind
says of, alone.
Any kind of sport and current affairs, which is why you can't get him out of the office. Ooh.
Yes, very good.
Does Angela have a pen? No, I won't do this. We'll leave it there.
He's written that himself, obviously. We're all
Yeah. He's too modest to mention it, but he has written that himself.
And he's too arrogant to get an editor. Yeah. Because somebody would rip the shit out of that if somebody got hold of it who actually knew what they were doing.
That is incredible. That's better than any Wikipedia page that has been self-edited that we've seen here. Is the website of the England scrum half.
He refers to himself as the boss, like he's Bruce Springsteen.
But think about this, right? You're two Welsh people, right?
Hmm.
So what you've got here is 80s England, Cambridge, scrum half, now estate agent, refers to himself as the boss or the governor. I mean, in terms of the we would like you to die bingo for a Welsh, that's too harsh. But in terms of everything that being a Welsh rugby fan despises about rugby in England is probably the full house, isn't it? It's the royal force.
It's very close. It's very. It could only be any higher if he was good.
Yes, or he worked in the city. If he was good and trading floor or something. Speaking of somebody who's from a rugby league background, I despise him. So it must be really, really bad for you. So
I'm just about keeping.
Then again, you do support England, Lee. So
well, I know. That's not his choice. You can't. You know, it's difficult, isn't it? Really.
It's true. Certainly support is a strong word.
Certainly in this game.
Yeah. There's a reason why we keep getting you on for England losing games.
They're the ones I like best, though, just because they're just funny. You can't get too upset about it, especially in this game. This is, honestly, though, this is like watching the Flintstones isn't it though, in terms of when you watch rugby every week like we do, and especially yeah. you guys do, analysing the shit out of it, I just try and laugh at things, but you analyse the crap out of it. It is like watching the Flintstones or something. It's yeah. prehistoric stuff, man.
It's a cartoon version of the thing.
Not
you're
even
watching.
A good way, not in a kind of a knocking shit out of each other way, just in a kind of everyone's just terrible.
Oh,
mostly
yeah.
way.
Again, like if you go back and watch 60s cartoons that you hear are supposed to be great, I'm like, this is very slow and racist.
Yes. Yeah.
But,
yeah, if 2011 was Power Rangers, this is the Flintstones.
Yes.
Should we do the Devereux try? So, because I've
yeah,
got
let's.
Some stuff on after the game as well I want to mention quickly before we wrap up.
Okay. I mean, is it Peter Williams left-footed who throws the pass?
I'd stop it.
I think it is. Maybe.
No, I think he loops yeah. around Jamie Salmon and then throws the world's most telegraphed pass to John Devereux, who's just waiting there.
The largest, strongest man in the backs. Yeah,
indeed.
In a bright
indeed.
Red shirt. Yeah.
Who I'm pretty sure starts celebrating before he catches the ball.
Does. Yeah. And does that rugby sevens hold it over the ground so you absolutely have to touch it down?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and intercepts it and goes all 20 metres to the try line and scores, and it is converted. And Wales wins 16-3 in an absolute thriller. Sorry to provoke the referee there.
Also, England had a penalty. They called a scrum and they ran this play. Like, they were clearly really confident.
Play
this.
Is a generous word.
Yeah.
Because actually, in all fairness, that was the only thing they had. They literally just went, you know, in old terms, wipers left or wipers right.
Yeah.
Hands, basically. It was just, that's all they had, with no alignment and nobody changing angle at all.
Yeah. And even then, they usually dropped it by the third
yeah.
or fourth person.
But that, mercifully, that's the best thing to do, because but the number of times it just went bump, 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 kick. Bump,
yeah.
Bump,
yeah.
Bump, kick. Because there was just all the times it actually got beyond the second pair of hands and wasn't powerballing all over the place. Yeah.
I mean, like, fair play to Devereux for catching one of England's passes, because their own team couldn't do it.
Let me show you how it's done, Beb.
Yeah.
There's a point at which I think when it's, you know, when the full reality of what's happening has somehow taken this long to sink in, where they have a shot at the England coach in the crowd, and it's beautifully done just as he's putting his head in both his hands. Thinking, you know, I could be sat in the fucking Bullwankers Club in Richmond right now. Instead, I'm sat here watching this miles away from home.
Also, on that note, is there a single coach in this tournament who doesn't smoke?
It's very low, isn't it? The no one is as bad as the French coach, who was known for smoking like up to 20 cigarettes a game.
But I think I saw both coaches smoking at some stage in this game.
Yeah.
But to be fair, I nearly took it smoking about 3 or 4 times in this game, so...
The Welsh coach, Tony Gray, the Welsh coach, looks exactly like Jim Telfer.
Yeah, actually. Mm.
To the point which I was thinking, why is Jim Telfer here? And then it was after a while, I was like, it can't be Jim. Because even to the tinted glasses and everything, it was exactly very, very strange. In full suit and Mac. Gotta love that.
The
team doctors are in full suit and Mac when they come on in this. It's incredible. When the doctor's out there, he's in a shirt and tie.
Sent with Dai Young to go and get their suits.
Yes,
all exactly. together.
See, that's how it's done. He could do it, and he's at work. Yeah.
So, right, this game finishes, thank God. The Wales team are delighted. They'll go off singing, cheering. They're very, very happy. A kid pats one of them on the back and they don't notice. And then, right, this is a quote from Mark Ring gave an interview to Wales Online a few years ago, where he talked about the aftermath of this game. He said, I remember we were all very hungry coming back to the hotel, but the restaurant was closed. We said, we are the Welsh rugby team and we've just beaten England. We're starving. Any chance you could open up and do some burger and chips or something? And they said, not a chance, no. But it just so happened that Brian Robson...
Wait, you see, Mark Ring says all this. He didn't fucking play.
Yeah.
You've not beaten England. The guy who beat you to the shirt scored an interception try.
So it just happened, right, that Brian Robson, who was the Man United captain at the time, was staying in the same hotel because he'd been playing some preseason games in Australia to get some game time after injury before the start of the you know, the Premier League season or the First Division season it was at the time. So Brian comes over, sees them and goes, "What's the problem, lads?" At which point, John Devereaux explains the situation to him and he says, "Leave it to me." He had a word and it reopened straight away.
Wow.
So Brian Robson gets the thing opened up and then spends the night celebrating with the Welsh team.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I was going to say about Robson was shit-faced.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Mark Ring goes on to say they had a private bar and he paid for all the beer, which, like, you look at this Welsh team, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Moriarty's alone. It's a lot.
Yeah. Mark Ring says, "I sat next to him. We had drinking games and he was the last one to bed. He was absolutely fantastic. A really good guy."
That's good. I guess the moral of the story is, if you want a big night out, just hang around with the Man United captain.
Yep.
That make sure he's nearby. United captain, yeah.
Yeah.
And so then, right, that was, you know, night out after a big win, you know, against, anyway, all of this, etc. John Devereaux then mentions in another interview, right, that England had booked a hotel on the Gold Coast for 3 days R&R after the game, assuming they'd win. They'd booked like a luxury hotel. And when Wales beat them, they had to hand the reservation over to Wales.
Oh, God. Wonder who did it. Who actually had to hand it over?
Do you reckon it was the prime estate agent, Richard Harding?
Yeah, the key. Like the Ashes trophy. Yeah.
That is the epic story that they won't tell. The epic origin story.
In what world did England think they were going to win this game to a level which they booked a luxury hotel? Because, I mean, there was nothing about 80s England which suggested they were... I know Wales were about to go on their downward trend from this year onwards, but it definitely wasn't here yet.
No, not quite.
I mean, yeah, like, they were shit, but England were a whole lot worse. And, like, I know that they didn't do captain's runs, but if they did... they surely can't have seen, like, they're dropping every third pass and going, like, yeah, we're going to fucking steamer all of these guns.
Yeah. So Adrian Hadley said, "People said it was arrogant of England to have booked the hotel in advance, but our management hadn't booked anything. They clearly didn't have much faith in us."
And again, what made you think you were going to lose this game? To flip side of the same coin. Yeah.
John Devereaux then follows up, "In hindsight, we probably shouldn't have gone on the piss for 4 days in the middle of a World Cup."
That's one of those classic ones. You don't really need hindsight to know that.
Yeah. No, but hey, it was the first World Cup. Somebody had to learn it the hard way, eh?
Jiffy then adds in a quip, "Although we wouldn't have beaten New Zealand even if they'd been on the piss all week."
It's this kind of whiff which keeps him in the media.
Yeah, classic Jiffy line there. Classic Jiffy line. And I think that kind of sets up where this tournament goes for Wales from very, very neatly. But that kind of brings England's to a close. They head home after this.
Yeah.
Lee, what are your thoughts and takes on this England team?
It wasn't very good, full stop. I think, but I mean, it's. I think what you're realizing is it's after this that you start to get the shift towards what happened in 90, from 89 onwards into 91. Mm. That was when Jack Ryle started getting moved in, when they finally gave the job to Richard Hill and Rob Andrew, when they finally, you know, Carling started being eased in. You know, it wasn't England's fault that Guscott wasn't around yet. You know, so that's a bit of a change when that comes in. John Webb showed why he stuck around for a while.
Yeah,
in a kind of weakling sort of way, but sort of did play pretty well. So I think there was the kind of, because I think Rendell didn't last much longer after this. Mm. Winterbottom kept going. Richard stuck around, but it was kind of very much the last knockings of it being an embarrassment, as it had been for a while, really. And I suppose credit in some ways to the RFU, just that we have to do something about this.
Yeah.
Whether that's a coaching or whether they actually make some decisions, because it was, you know, it was as unacceptable then as it was between 2003 and 2013, you know, so, well, 15, really, in terms of how fucking shite it was. But so that's my kind of takeaway. I don't know how, and I suppose the main thing watching it is I know it was raining, but I literally don't know what they were coached.
Yeah.
You know, when you watch the game, it's like, I don't know what you coached. It seems to be just boot it randomly or just throw it hands left or right randomly with no real thought to it. And maybe that was symptomatic of the... I've not watched enough of this tournament to know, but it feels symptomatic of...
Oh, you've watched enough of this tournament.
And it feels symptomatic of the game, of the sport itself, perhaps, at the time, you know. The fact they were on the piss and not really practicing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I take it we've reached a point where effectively at the England leaving party, but England have been that boring that we're not going to bother putting music on in the background. No. That we're just gonna leave them to rot. And like, fair play, because I have never seen an England team as comprehensively bland as this. Where like, you know, like
and you saw the Shane Geraghty team.
Right, yeah. Like, I hadn't heard of the captain, you know, that kind of thing. Like, usually that kind of thing, it holds quite a big legacy for the first of World Cup as well. But, like, it's your point spot on there, Lee, that, like, fair play to the RFU for turning this round and making sure there's never been an era like this again where, like, because I'm pretty confident, having watched this tournament, that if England played any of the other Five Nations teams, that they would have struggled. And as I say, like, I don't think this Wales team's particularly good. And for England to go out to these, it's, you know, not a great result. I think Rory Underwood's been bloody brilliant.
Rory Underwood's great.
I think he's an absolutely fantastic player, and I've loved watching Dean Richards play as well. Just for I have, for the birth of shithousery, because like all he does is cheat and stamp on people, and he's really good at being that guy in this team. And Brian Moore as well. Brian Moore.
I was going to
really
say
good.
That. Yeah, I think because this was kind of Brian Moore's breakthrough. That he'd won his first cap in the Six Nations or the Five Nations early that year. But this was where he kind of took the England shirt and he came in for a couple of smaller games and just kept the shirt and kept
it.
He's
still at Nottingham at this point, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yes. Comes up quite a lot in the commentary. They keep mentioning Brian Moore of Nottingham.
Yeah. Him and Gary Rees of Long Eaton, of course.
Yes, of course.
Is he still around?
I don't know. But I only found out on this podcast that he's a Long Eaton boy, which is quite embarrassing. But.
But yeah, I think Brian Moore stands out as a, you know, as I think I've said this before, but as Dane Coles 10 years ago was like, oh, that's the mold all hookers are going to be in 10 years.
Sure.
And that's kind of caught up now. And all hookers are a version of Dane Coles. I think at the time you could see Brian Moore coming through and going like, oh, that is what all hookers are going to be in the 90s.
Yeah. This was his first full campaign, wasn't it?
Yeah, as I say, he won his first cap in the Five Nations, but kind of took the England shirt here during this tournament.
Yeah.
And he is very much the... You know, still a shithouse, still a prick, but can play a bit, you know, can like handle the ball if he has to. He's quite sharp. Does a lot of the kind of like clearing up work, like Kevin Mealama used to do a lot. That kind of like just being there on the scene whenever you need someone.
And
to
you can hear him on the ref mic shouting, get this bastard off it, which is always great.
Get it away again. Yeah, I think if I had to pick an England player of the tournament, I think I'd go for Brian Moore.
It's between Moore and Underwood for me.
And Lee, if you had to vote out that you don't, based on one game.
Well, we're going to do Man of the Match.
Yeah, let's just move on to it. Let's do that. Let's do that anyway. Yeah.
Apart from Peter Williams, obviously, he's now the greatest England player in the history of,
there we go.
Of the entire sport. Yeah.
So, should we start on Man of the Match? Should we move on there?
Sure. Lee, go on. You can start. You seem
I
keen.
Thought... On the QT, even though I've not mentioned him much, I thought Gareth Roberts played pretty well for a man who was knocked out a lot of the time. In a game like this, he was kind of quietly doing a lot of stuff, which I thought was quite good. But then again, I'm always kind of attracted to blindside flank positions, performances. So honestly, I thought not the most eye-catching, but I actually watching it and the try course, I thought he did pretty well.
Yeah, I had Roberts written down as one of mine. So I also had written down Rob Jones, who I've also said, as I said, I think he was excellent. I think he, given the standard, he was excellent. You know, he kicked well, he passed well. Generally, he cleared up shit ball pretty well. But I think generally, after everything that's happened, my man of the match has to be Maria.
God, I hope she's all right.
Yeah, me too. So do I.
She deserves the last 10 years she's found happiness with a person who deserves her.
Yeah. Indeed.
Mike Williams, maybe. Peter Williams, maybe.
Or Mike Williams.
Or maybe the former Exeter lock.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I hate having to pick a man of the match here.
Shit, innit?
I mean, so, really, John Devereux, I think, plays pretty well, I guess, all considered. But, you know, Yian Evans is fun whenever he gets the ball, as is Rory Underwood, but neither of them get enough of it to make an impact. And I think really, if you're picking a player who stands out the most to me, it probably is Rob Jones. However, right, whilst watching this game, I picked up my phone and I had a quick scroll through Twitter and I saw a video of Robert De Niro on Sesame Street. And in this video, Robert De Niro is talking to Elmo. And there's a whole bit where Elmo's basically, because Robert De Niro is the greatest living actor in all of this, and he's kind of like, oh, can you pretend you're a cabbage? And Robert De Niro is like, sure, I'll pretend I'm a cabbage. And then it cuts away and cuts back. And Robert De Niro is now played by a puppet cabbage. And he's voiced by Robert De Niro. And it was a very funny bit. And for that reason, my man of the match is Robert De Niro pretending to be a cabbage.
Fantastic. That's great. That's a really specific man of the match.
It should be Robert Jones if we're sticking to players from this game.
I mean, Maria's taken one vote, so
the thing that gave me the most joy whilst watching this game.
While we're on Robert Jones and Harding, I loved Man of the Match. He was probably that UK broadcast commentator. He was the most miserable and yet cutting man I've ever heard in my life. Right, at least four times he said the game is terrible. At one point, he says, and I wrote it down word for word because I was so astounded by it. At a scrum, he said, Robert Jones standing almost contemptuous of the Bristol scrum half as Harding was just putting the ball in. It was absolutely wonderful. Also, he did something I've never really thought about before. He called them lines out.
Huh. Yes.
Lines out. As opposed to like courts.
He really stumbled over that though, didn't he?
Yeah,
he spent ages trying to figure out the plural of line out.
Because it's not court martials, is it? It's courts martial. And he obviously took the view that lines out, or sisters in law, or you know, it was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I got, Jesus, have I been, you know, oh my God, scales are four. Have I been saying this wrong the whole time? Is it lines out? I might start doing that anytime I cover rugby again to see if anybody says anything.
Just see what happens. Until like Victor Matfield tells us otherwise.
Yes.
So your man of the match is Robert De Niro as Cabbage.
I guess so.
Yeah. Two-thirds of us have avoided
the kind of
game
it was.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. I wonder how many episodes of this podcast, this specific series, we've avoided giving man of the match to a specific player in the team. Because that joke has probably run dry quite a long time ago.
Yes.
But also, so did watching these games.
Absolutely did. We're almost there, though. We're almost through this.
Have you enjoyed any of the games thus far?
Yeah, a couple of them. Anyway, so it's time for Dicks of the Day. Not Dick of the Days, Dicks of the Day.
Nice. Will, do you want to start?
Yes. The thing is, originally I had Jiffy as a contender because I was thinking, like, it's only fair that as Wales bow out of this World Cup, I give it to Jiffy, who's always been the guy. Then I realised, like, no, just because they played shit doesn't mean they're getting knocked out. I have to watch Wales again in a couple of weeks.
Yep.
It's awful. Then the other one is, on the flip side of the exact same coin, Richard Harding being the one I usually pick on for England for that backwards kick is the other thing. But realistically, I have to give it to left-footed Peter Williams for that drop goal attempt.
How dare you? Think about Maria, for the love of God.
Think about Maria.
I've given him out of the match.
On the similar bit, my Dick of the Day is Mike Harrison for most of what he did.
Yeah.
Yeah. But particularly booting a chip through straight into Paul Thorburn's face was probably my favourite bit. And the one bit of daylight he had in the entire game, he still managed to balls up completely.
And I mean, look, Mike Harrison
is your favourite player.
Yes. He is still, yep. He's still on track to be in the team of the tournament.
Bear in mind, this tournament has John Kerwin, David Campisi, you know, Yian Evans, Rory Underwood all playing in it.
At the minute, I'm scrolling through the players with the most man of the match votes, and it's two dogs, Mike Harrison and Superboot.
And a cabbage.
Now a cabbage climbing the ranks. And Grant Fox is below them.
We've got, like, what, four or five more games? And let me tell you, if Robert De Niro dressed up as a cabbage gets another vote, I won't be too surprised at this stage. Could be crawling into that team of the tournament.
But look, there's a point in which Jiffy has an overlap and he just thumps it randomly in the air. And for that, I can't possibly give it to anyone else.
Respect.
For me screaming numbers and him not doing it.
Just tweet him that clip every time he's on commentary from now on.
So when we were first going through the fixtures of this World Cup, because Jiffy still follows me for some reason, we had a conversation about potentially getting Jiffy on. And you know what?
Probably for this very game, wasn't it?
Yeah. I'm very glad we got you instead, Lee.
Oh, thank you very much.
Indeed.
I mean, I will say one final thing about Wales before they move on. You'll cover this in the next game. But this victory is probably the thing that knackered Wales up for the next probably 4 to 8 years. Because that victory got them seeded for 91, by which time they were fucking terrible. And then that got them in the situation where they ended up in everything that happened in 91.
That's incredible to think they could get worse.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? But yeah, I'm all moderately. Well, obviously, there was an excess of our afters, but I know we have run out of time. But yeah, so that's the thing I reflected at the end in terms of where Wales were at. Is it's really shred. This seemed like a very big achievement in a way, which it was. It actually sowed the seeds of even more nightmare in 4 years' time.
It'll just keep going. Oh, we'll get to that eventually. what a treat that's going to be. It's going to be like that, but Wales are crap. They're even worse somehow.
Like they're crap and they're losing.
Yeah. Finally doubling down. So, yeah, Lee, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for sitting through the game. Where can people find you? Where can people find things? Where will people be able to find Blood and Mud when it's back?
Well, thank you for the invite. Thank you for letting me share this with you. I am at Blood and Mud on Twitter. And if you want to pay a bit more and get a bit more content, we're at patreon.com/bloodandmud, where for £20 a year or £2 a month you can get extra episodes, including one we're doing next Monday, where we're doing the next Monday as we're recording this, where we're doing the New Zealand versus rest of the world 15 from 1992, from the centenary of the NZRFU.
That sounds better than this game.
So I'll send you the link and you can watch it, and then you can watch along or whatever on Monday. Yeah,
brilliant.
That's our summer episode. But thank you, at Blood and Mud.
Yeah.
No, thank you for coming on. That's been a real joy. And as we've said before, you know, I mean, we are obviously in touch, but we are both fans of your podcast and enjoy listening to that. So it's great that you can, you know, bring that crossover to here. And also, we've said this before, but everybody who listens to this also listens to Blood and Mud. So I'm sure both of them are very grateful.
Our listenership, like the Venn diagram of our listenerships, is a circle inside a more smaller circle.
Yeah.
that's just how this lines up. Yeah. Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you, Will.
You're welcome.
We made it. We did it. We got through this game. Please join us next week when we're covering the final quarterfinal as Ireland's curse begins. As they lose 33-15 to Australia, which...
In the 3 points for a try period, that's a fucking thumping, isn't it? Proper. Yeah.
And somehow I feel like it's about to get even worse than we've had today.
I don't know. It sounds like there's actual points and tries there. So yeah, so we'll see you then. Until then, thank you everybody, and please do not watch this game.
Yes, that's the perfect advice to end on. Thanks everyone.
Yeah. Bye. Remember to hang out with Man United captains.
And the referee has blown his whistle to mercifully release us all from this tedious 80 minutes of rugby here at Ballymore this afternoon. Two very poor teams having an off day, but in the end, the Welsh deserved to win, and they did so by 16 points to 3.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.